The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Nia Patel. In today's episode, I'm speaking with two guests, Jamie Leung and Sam Ongere, two nutrition support dietitians, and we're going to be discussing blended diets in transitional care and what best practice looks like. Hello, both of you, and welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast. So today we're going to be talking about blended diets in transitional care and also what best practice looks like. But before we launch into all of that, I would love to learn a little bit more about you both. Perhaps, Sam, we begin with you. What's your current role at the moment and what does your caseload look like?
Yeah, so my name is Sam Ogundere and I'm a specialist dietitian in home enteral feeding. I work in a multidisciplinary team and I have been doing so for the last sort of like 5 years. Great team, you know, great people. Yeah, I really love it. And our caseload of adults, actually, so our caseload of adults has been increasing. The dietitians manage about 280-ish adults. Yes. So we cover three different London boroughs. And we have such a variety of conditions, like patients that have their sort of tubes inserted, you know, right from stroke, MND, Parkinson's, GI disorders, cancer. Yeah, there's such a range, cerebral palsy, yeah, as well, such a range. Most of our patients have PEG tubes or balloon gastrostomy tubes.
Okay.
But we do have a sort of a smaller percentage with nasal tubes and jejunal tubes.
Okay, no, that's interesting. And Jamie, I mean, are you doing the same type of work and caseload?
Yeah, so my name is Jamie Leung. I'm a paediatric dietitian working with the HEN team. My work is very similar to Sam's, only that in the children's service, we tend to sit in many multidisciplinary teams that are across the different trusts, and because we work over three boroughs, and we look after similar caseload, cerebral palsy mainly, and then lots of genetic conditions that predisposes children to need enteral nutrition. We look after about 200 odd in our caseload, and most of our children would have a PEG tube, but some of them still use an NG tube because they're fairly young. So yeah, we look after children from the age 0 to 18, 19, and then we transition to the adult service when situation allows, circumstance. If they leave a school, they go into a different school, that would be a good time to do transitioning.
Yeah.
So there isn't really a black and white cutoff point for transitioning. But yeah, so because we sit together in the same team, it's very easy for us to support the transitioning to adult service.
Yeah, what a powerful and important duo in terms of that aspect of transition, which we're going to talk about a little bit more. But let's first talk about homemade blended diets for patients. I mean, what's your experience in using these type of diets and how has that evolved over time in both your roles?
I'll let you start with that, Jamie.
Yeah, that actually makes sense because usually it starts off when children are younger. So we've had sort of roughly about maybe just under 5% of our caseload would have blended diet at home fully. So what that means is that they would have a blended diet or homemade blended diet food in their tube for all three meals a day, and probably about 30% of our caseload would have some blended diet during the day. So they would use a commercial formula as well as having some homemade food that mum would blend and put down the tube for them. So got quite a bit of experience from what mum has told us, you know. We're collecting lots of stories and lots of recipes that parents share with us. And so far, it's been very positive from what parents are reporting to us. Positive mainly in the sense of just tolerance. Some of the children sometimes experience difficulty with feed tolerance and present itself as either vomiting or just very, discomfort from the actual feeding itself. So the next sort of logical step for most parents would be to sort of share their food at home with their children and try and modify the food that they can blend at home to suit the needs of their children. So that sort of is a natural thing for parents to do. And the tolerance has been much better since parents have started doing it. So I guess the opportunity is that a lot more parents would learn how to do it and they would, you know, obviously be very keen to share their experience with others. And I guess the challenge would still be the support. The support we're getting is not across the board. So some schools would be very keen to support it for parents to bring in the blended food to the school. And some schools are very strict about not having blended food to the school. So that's kind of the things that we're seeing.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Sam?
So I've got much more limited experience compared to Jamie. Because in the adult world, it's not really sort of a large percentage of our caseload at all. At the moment, we've got sort of two young adults that are sort of partially using a homemade blend and sort of commercial feed. And we've got an older adult actually that's come over from another country where it's fairly normal there for them to use sort of like homemade blends. Yeah, so it's really interesting actually because she's a recent referral and she's got a huge tube. So it's a tube size that we don't sort of use in the UK at all.
Wow.
But in her country, that's sort of like very normal. And she's literally just blending her meals that she was having before she had her tubing started.
Wow.
So like porridge, bananas, coffee.
Brilliant. That would be
all goes into one blend. And then she uses like a big syringe and pours it into a big syringe and it goes through the tube. So she does that like three times a day. And she might have a snack. So she said she might have like coffee and cookies, like a little chocolate chip cookie, blend that and have that as her snack, which is amazing. Because we haven't really sort of seen that in our sort of like adult caseload yet. And I know sort of with the young adult that we have, they sort of were very established on using a homemade blend and commercial feed when they came from the children's team. So the parents, you know, they knew that that's what suited their child the best. He's got great tolerance, like of everything, like his bowels work really well. He doesn't have any sort of adverse GI symptoms and like vomiting or the reflux. He had an operation when he was quite young to sort of be able to, not cure the reflux.
Yeah.
But they found like using a homemade blend and a commercial feed has been the best fit for him.
Yeah.
So I think from our point of view, as an adult service, when we have children that are transitioning, we would have to support that, isn't it? Because their age changes doesn't mean that suddenly, everything that they need is going to change.
Yeah.
So they're 1 year older, 2 years older. So, you know, things sort of need to continue and stay the same and keep them like well and happy. So.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit more around the transitional services later, because obviously, you know, at the moment you mentioned you don't have that many within the adult service, but that will obviously increase as more people transition from kind of childhood adolescence into adulthood. But before we go into that, Jamie, you mentioned, you know, very clearly what the opportunities were and the challenges obviously being support from the schools. Are there local trust guidelines or national guidelines that help with blended diets? And perhaps within those guidelines, is there something there around unifying the support so that patients are kind of supported to make sure that they're able to kind of comply with using blended diets?
Yeah, this is a interesting area because so the our professional body, the British Dietitians Association, has just I think last year, was it the year before, came out with the toolkit that supports dietitians working in the community and mainly in the community to support parents, facilitating blended diet use down the tube. So the whole thing is quite new professionally to us. Prior to the BDA, you know, coming up with this guidance, I guess individual dietitians were supporting their patients because they maybe perhaps they can see the benefits and therefore they had provided support in the past against, or not necessarily against BDA guidance, but without the BDA sort of support behind them. The local guideline situation is also interesting because I think a lot of the trusts nowadays are coming out with their own guidelines. So we wrote ours in Greenwich and Lewisham for children about 3 years ago. So 3 years ago, we wrote our guideline for use in the community. And the reason why I keep saying community and not community is because hospital, as in acute services, would have their own guideline because of sort of infection control within the hospital environment. So it's much harder for our acute colleagues to come up with guidance just because each ward would maybe present different situations. So it's much easier for community services to come up with their own guidelines if they're looking after a specific area to get local agreements and use the same guideline. The challenges we have in the work that we do here is that we look after three boroughs in London. So each borough have their own different nursing team support and different children's service organizations to have to harmonize the guideline with. So actually it's very hard for us to come up with a single guideline for the three boroughs. So we've been working on just, you know, on the one guideline and getting individual agreements. So I'll be going into the school with my guideline and saying, this is what we're using in Lewisham Greenwich. Are you happy to follow similar things? And they've been sort of either agreeing or not agreeing, depending on their individual situation in the school. So that's kind of the challenge we've been having. And to mitigate that challenge, we've been just coming up with very general sort of foot hygiene guidance, mainly for the schools to support the parents with.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. Sam, do you have anything else to add there?
Yeah, well, what Jamie didn't say is that she worked very hard on sort of putting those guidelines together herself. So she spent a lot of time and sort of did a lot of research around that. And at the moment, the policy is for children, isn't it? For children sort of in the community. But what we're doing is looking at sort of including sort of that adults within that policy so that we've got a joint community policy across children and adults, and along with that sort of supporting information for patients as well, isn't it, to give them and all the sort of steps along the way.
Brilliant, because it sounds like it's so integrated, which is exactly what we need along kind of care pathways. So I love the work that you guys are doing there. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about food-derived or tube feeds with food-derived ingredients. What are your thoughts on these?
Should I go first?
Go on.
I really embrace it with open arms, just because understanding our patient caseload that is specific to our service, a lot of the parents actually don't have a lot of time. And living in London, as you can imagine, a lot of people have very small accommodations, so they may have a very small kitchen. They may not necessarily be able to afford a good blender, or have the, and they may not be able to, have the room in the freezer to do batch preparation, so to speak. So actually, it's very useful for some of our parents who may want to, have been expressing that they really wanted to have blended diet for their children, but they have all these limitations. And and even before the limitations, some of them would actually say, I wish I could just try it to see if it would help with, you know, tolerance or if my child would even accept something like that before they commit to buying all the equipment and doing all the preparation work. Because it's quite a big ask, really, for a very busy mum to be able to do batch preparation, freezing, blending, and then reheating and then rotating. You know, there's a lot of work in it. So I really like the idea, and I think it offers an alternative to most of our parents who express interest.
I would agree. It's you know, that will sort of follow through into the adult sort of community as well. And I think people don't really know that it's an option at the moment, but it's like another option we could lay out for our adult patients. You know, who do want to sort of include some sort of food, you know, in their diet, but sort of don't necessarily want to sort of take that step straight away. And I imagine also for patients when they go into hospital, isn't it, when they're not able to sort of take their homemade blend with them, that this is an alternative, isn't it, to sort of use the sort of the cheap feed with the food-derived ingredients. So I think it, it will definitely have a big place, won't it, for our patients that are interested in home blend.
And why do you think there's not much awareness around the fact that it's an option?
That probably is because as dietitians, I suppose, it's not really an option that we would have laid out a few years ago.
Okay, because it's new.
Yeah, I think, don't you think? If somebody was suffering from like sort of bloating and sort of constipation and diarrhea, it wouldn't be our first.
I think the research, I think the research behind the products was small to start off with. There weren't a lot of evidence to support the use of blended diet. And Sam's completely right. I think naturally, if we see a patient who's not tolerating feed or having other issues, we would very naturally go to the medical solution as a first line. We consult the consultants and then see, you know, what can we do, and all sorts of things. So but it's, I think evidence is building up. The body of evidence is now building up and is quite strong. And I feel that the products are, I mean, the, you know, this blended diet for children, the commercial, the food-derived ingredients feeds, it's quite new, isn't it? I mean, it was, it came to market a few years ago. So it's all new to us. And I think a lot of the feeding regimes get started in the hospital.
Yeah.
And if the hospital is having difficulty with the idea of blended diet because of food hygiene problems or whatever, then this product will not necessarily be their first thought when they are explaining to parents what options were. So I think it's all new when we are learning a lot more about it.
And then if we look at transitional care, I mean, what does transitional care look like at your services? Because it sounds like you guys are doing a fantastic job in this area. So what does it look like in practice? Jamie, we'll start with you, maybe.
Go on, Jamie.
So I'm kind of thinking along as that sort of like a flowchart of what we normally do. So we'll come up with a list of children who are maybe you know, finishing secondary school, say for example, reaching the age of 18, kind of 19, that kind of age, and they would usually be transitioned. Their medical service would get transitioned to the adult medical teams. So that would be a good opportunity, because if the adult service are picking up all the medical care, then it will also make sense for the adult team, dietetically and nursing wise, to also pick up the service. What it will look like is we will follow sort of our team's guideline. Sam would initiate a sort of email initiation of introductions, and then saying when should we do the joint sort of visits together. So nursing, dietitians may well do a joint visit together first.
Yeah, that's right. With our paediatric colleagues, so Jamie and the rest of the team, so we share a patient record system. So it's sort of very easy for us to sort of like see what's been happening with the patient. So, you know, but quite often we do the verbal handover, but it's the children's nursing team that our nurses, you know, also like to visit with. So it might be that we might do a joint, you might do a joint visit with our adult nurses, or I might do a visit with the children's nursing team. We'll say, we'll kind of decide what's most appropriate. And that's kind of what we call the transition assessment. So it's an opportunity for us to introduce our adult service and the differences between the children and the adult service and what they can expect. And then also for the children's team to sort of just pick up any kind of like loose ends or any questions the parents might have from their side. So it's a bit of a coming together. And then from that appointment, you sort of have an official
handover.
From children to adults. That's how we sort of do it within our team at the moment.
I mean, a vital part of that sounds like, you know, the multidisciplinary team kind of working together is key for the success of a good, smooth transition. Are there any other things that you, from your experience, or things that work really well that support children who are transitioning?
Communication is key, obviously, okay. and that teamwork. I think if we don't have that joint visit, there are bits that are missing, because I think from the adult service, we don't know all the kind of social bits that have been going on with families, and sort of quite often our children's team is filling all the gaps there for us, which helps us to sort of be able to understand, you know, what the family's been through, you know, where they're at the moment, because sometimes by the time they come to adult services, they know exactly what they're doing. They don't necessarily want you to sort of come in and change things, which, you know, which we don't need to do, but you're kind of coming in a gentle way and saying, you know, this is what we can offer and how we can support you. I think mainly it's the communication and the teamwork side of things.
And I think that parents really appreciate that transitioning meeting, because they obviously they've known me, you know, for a long time, because I've seen their, you know, children grow and stuff. Mm. And when it transitions into adult service, sometimes parents can get very scared of not knowing who's going to pick up the care or who can I contact if there is a problem.
Yeah.
So actually it's very reassuring for our parents to know that we work in the same team.
Of course.
And we do that visit together, and, you know, they feel very safe, I think, that, you know, there is a linkage there. And, you know, Jamie, I can, you know, sometimes they do still call me, and then I just forward the call to my adult colleagues at the very beginning after transitioning, because they're not quite used to it. But that doesn't matter. At least they have someone to call and they know who to call.
So, and it's amazing that you're both in the same team as well.
So it's like the same number. So it's like, so it's quite nice for them. They're like, the same number.
Brilliant.
So that's really good. I think also the preparation, isn't it, of the parents for transitioning?
Yes.
Because I think that sometimes needs a bit of a long lead in. So for them to have sort of notice to understand the process, what's going to happen, and then get that agreement that, okay, you know, we're ready to transition now. Do you agree with that? So that they're all on board.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then if I play devil's advocate a little bit here, what happens to those patients who can't do homemade blends, for example, within the transition?
We haven't got to that
stage,
have we?
No, we've not had that experience yet. But I should imagine if that came today, let's say we're the patient who needs to transition and they can't continue doing the blend, I suppose the most natural sort of option for them would be, you know, the food-derived ingredient feed that we can introduce to them.
Okay.
And it may well be that just before transitioning, they may need to ease themselves or titrate a little bit at a time to get used to, you know, something different from what they're used to from homemade food. But, you know, and that will be the closest that we can offer them, I guess.
I mean, the hope is that there would have to be a medical reason as to why they wouldn't continue with their homemade sort of food blend, really, wouldn't it?
Or maybe a very social, practical reason that I couldn't, something like that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, we're working partnership, really, wouldn't we? We'd probably still liaise with our paediatric colleagues anyway to sort of try and make it work.
Yeah. No, sounds good. And the future, I mean, what do you think the future looks like for home enteral feeding dietitians when it comes to both homemade blended diets and also tube feeds with food derived ingredients?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be another option that we have, like in our mental toolkit.
Yeah.
When we're thinking about feeds for patients and the kind of symptoms and the tolerance that, you know, that they have with the feeds, we would have to just put that as another, I think, as another option in our little pocketbook, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I guess with more research and more evidence supporting the use of both,
yeah,
not necessarily just homemade blend, but also food-derived ingredients, it's going to become more useful as part of our tool to support patients who may experience tolerance difficulties with feeding, and you know, and just for the, those patients who prefer to have that option, you know, and it's no different, or it's definitely not inferior to our usual feeds in terms of, you know, supporting growth and well-being, then I guess there is no reason why we cannot go to the food-derived ingredients, feeds and home blends.
Yeah. And it would be good to have, I think, sort of the chew feed, food-derived ingredients, but with sort of like vegetarian. Having sort of non-meat based ones as well, isn't it? So you have start to have that little bit of variety.
More diversity there as well. Jamie, you mentioned special schools earlier, and I would love to get your inputs and thoughts into perhaps how you feel that, you know, special schools could be supported more in terms of resources and guidelines to kind of help them support children on blended diets.
Yeah, so special schools, obviously, it's very difficult for blended diet to be used in schools, just because for blended diet to be used in schools, there has to be a member of staff sitting with the child with a syringe and administering that blend over lunchtime. So imagine in a class of maybe five children, if all five of them need to have blended diet, you'll need five members of staff sitting there for at least a good half an hour, you know, putting in that syringe, two, three, four syringes full, maybe with a little break in between. So actually there's a resource demand there to start off with. Staffing demand, resource demand, training for the staff to be able to administer blend, because staff in special needs school are so used to using the feeding pump. And therefore, you know, when you turn it on, you can go away and do your things and the child would just sit there and receive the milk. But we are now moving away from that model. We are now saying you have to sit there with this child with a syringe and draw the blend out and then, you know, administer it. So that presents difficulty in itself for the staff, resource, training. And actually, before we even go there, the school head teacher would have to agree for their staff to take that, to take part in that activity. So, and the head teacher can only be supportive if there is guidance documents in place. So if they feel reassured in themselves that actually we've, you know, the school has been risk assessed, we are deemed to be, you know, suitable to be able to support that activity. So what I mean by that will be physical things like, you know, having a really working, well-functioning fridge to store the food from the morning to lunchtime, or having clean services, a dedicated sink, you know, hand washing, policies for sickness. All these things need to be there for the school to be able to support the use of blended diet for their children. So that's the kind of areas that I've been working with. And absolutely right, different trusts would have different guidance documents. Some trusts may be a lot more relaxed and say, you know, mum can just bring in whatever and then we'll just administer it. It doesn't really matter. Mum's going to take the responsibility. But other schools may be a little bit more strict and want to have something more concrete in their guidance document and a proper agreement set up between parents, school and the medical team, meaning maybe us, maybe the nursing team. Should the tube get blocked out, they may need to go in and change the tube. So there are a whole host of things that we need to get the school ready to support that.
Sam, from my conversations with other people on this podcast, you know, we see that, you know, blended diets, the trend is coming to adult services. So what steps would you take within your service to look after somebody on a homemade blender diet?
Well, if I use the example of the lady that I was talking about that come over from another country, who was already using blended diet. So she was telling me exactly what she was eating or putting through her tube. So I went on a joint visit with our nursing team, a nutrition nurse specialist. So I was looking at, I suppose, the nutritional adequacy of what she was having, which I suppose is part of our assessment and what we would do. So mainly the macronutrient part. But the other part was that I said, I think sort of having some nutritional bloods would be useful to see if there's any kind of deficiencies like with the micronutrients, just to see where we stand. And the sort of the tube part of everything, my nurse was like able to address, because this patient had a very sort of large tube, but it was a tube that we don't place in the UK. So I think when we're thinking about patients that are going to sort of start homemade blends, we do have to think about the type of tube that they've got in place and how easy that tube can be changed, but also what size the tube is as well. And also the administration, how they actually sort of put the blend through the tube. So this lady was using sort of gravity with like a very large syringe, like a 100ml syringe. And she was, I think there was about five syringes she used for her blend. So 500ml to get her full meal in that she wanted. So I think for us, sort of looking at the type of syringes that they need and how many they need is sort of what we would consider and sort of consider jointly with our sort of nursing team. So that they're the kinds of things actually that we would also sort of put in our policy and sort of practical guidelines. So in terms of monitoring, so for her, because she wants to continue with the sort of the homemade blends, I would say we'd want to sort of just check her nutritional bloods like every sort of 6 months.
Okay.
We'd monitor like any kind of symptoms that she was having, any kind of adverse symptoms. We'd also talk about like if she needed to go into hospital, like what she would do. And actually herself sort of said, oh, is there something that I could use if I need to sort of go out and I can't really sort of take my blend with me? So we talked about sort of just using sort of bottles, like to sort of bolus through the tube, you know, if she wants to go out for the day or, you know, sort of out for a couple of hours. So she was quite happy to sort of have that as an option. And obviously for her, I think sort of a tube feed with the sort of the food derived ingredients would probably, I think she would quite like to sort of hear about that option. And she probably would take it up. And we'd monitor her weight, etc., and sort of all the things we'd sort of normally dietetically
manage.
A report to the GP as well. We would let the GP know.
Yeah.
Sometimes GPs they don't sort of really know about the homemade blends, so we just have to let them know this is what's happening with the patient.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic, thank you. I've loved our conversations. I found it super valuable, and I know that our listeners would have as well. And as we draw the conversation to a close, I would love you to just maybe give our listeners a take-home message, a key take-home message, and maybe signpost them also to perhaps any tools or resources that you have found within your practice being beneficial for yourselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go first. Mm-hmm. As children, I would say please be open-minded.
Yeah.
With you know, suggestions from parents, and be open-minded about, and be very flexible with the approach of supporting that blended diet. And the resource I found very useful for myself, I really like the Aspergen guideline for children. So you can download this online. So the use of blended diet in children with enteral feeding tubes. That was published in 2023. That guidance document I find very, very useful.
Okay.
I like the BDA toolkit that use both. I think those are the resources that I would suggest.
Yeah. And I think it's really useful to sort of have the risk assessment forms as well, isn't it? So if and maybe just sort of like an information sort of like that you can give to patients if they're sort of interested in sort of like homemade food blends, isn't it? That's so you can either, you know, develop your own one or sort of, you know, use the BDA toolkit, yeah, sort of help put one together. I know there's other sort of trusts that have their own as well. So I think sort of sharing that's really good. And do you think a nutritional analysis program is a good tool? Or not?
I've slightly moved away from that, but yes, I think a nutrition analysis program would be very good. But as dietitians, I guess we all have tools in our head to be able to do a quick analysis as people tell us what they're cooking and eating.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't diminish that in any way, shape, or form. I think definitely a software that analyzes that can do nutrient analysis would be quite useful.
Yeah, because I guess we can do the macros quite well, but maybe it's the micronutrients sometimes, maybe for younger children or somebody who's a bit more vulnerable, that where that becomes more important. Well, Jamie and Sam, it's been wonderful talking to you. You really value the work that you're doing, and I've loved our conversation. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues and consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.